This is John at The Bible Project, and this week on the podcast, Tim and I finish a conversation on how the Bible is ancient Hebrew meditation literature. Last week, we talked about the story of Cain and Abel that you find on page 4 of the Bible. It's a classic story that highlights the Hebrew narrative style. It's short, confusing, ambiguous, and for millennia, people have studied and meditated on it. This week, Tim and I continue our conversation on the Cain and Abel story, and we discuss why meditation literature encourages this type of wrestling.
So why do we use the word meditation? It's actually the way the Bible portrays the ideal reader of this kind of literature. If you think about things like the Cain and Abel narrative, it's going to bring good things into your life, and that's what the Bible's designed to do.
Thanks for joining us. Here we go.
Do you want to summarize right now? Do you want me to try to?
I think we could summarize while looking at Psalm 1.
Oh, good. Great.
Yeah, but before we get to Psalm 1, can we just blitz through a couple more things in Genesis 4? Because,
okay.
I mean,
Since we're here.
We're here, and we're saying it's genius, and
okay. Yeah, good.
Let's just, continue on. So we got to the point where Cain is angry and downcast. We got to this really brilliant God statement of do what is right, sin is crouching at your door, it desires to have you, but you must rule over it. That's verse 7.
Yeah.
And we talked about that. All right.
Yeah.
Verse 8. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. Mm-hmm. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him.
Yeah.
That's a pretty, in two lines there, it's like,
yes.
All of a sudden you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
What just happened?
Okay. All right. That's a good, so think about the narrative technique here. We had Cain's response, anger.
Yes.
And fallen face. God says, you got a choice here.
Yep.
And what we don't get is a whole depiction
the
of the interior struggle of Cain.
Right.
And the scene of
him. It would make such a great scene. If we were going to make a movie out of this.
Him walking away from talking to God.
Yeah.
And being like, oh. And,
yeah. This is the Breaking Bad moment.
Yeah.
You know, he could be it could be over 5 episodes right now of Cain.
totally. Struggling with the decision. And,
yeah.
Yeah. It would be of him having dinner that night. In a dark room.
And he starts to plot, okay, I think I know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, totally. No. Well, all we get is, the next thing happens is Cain talks to his brother.
Let's go out to the field.
Let's go out to the field. Yeah. And you're like, wait, well, okay, the field. Well, the field is where Abel works. Hmm. Right? Or excuse me, where Cain works. Mm-hmm. Cain's a farmer.
Yeah.
And so let's go out to my territory. Hmm. And then all of a sudden, he rose up and slew his brother. And so you have to fill in the story there. What was he? Why did he do that? What was he thinking?
And you go back to the previous verse.
And all you have is
sin was crouching at his
door. He allowed the animal,
the predator sin, to devour him.
Sin to eat his lunch.
Have his way.
He chose not to rule over it. God's point was: you have a choice here. You can choose good and resist, or you can allow sin to overwhelm you. But you have the capacity to rule it.
And the consequences are so severe. It's killing your brother.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's not just taking a piece of fruit, in the parallel of the previous chapter.
Right, yeah. It's kind of like, what was the big deal about the fruit? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what about this story?
Yes.
Killing your own brother.
Yeah. So intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, and think about, there's two things happening here. One again, the previous verse 7. If you choose good. That's the hyperlink back to the good and not good, good and evil of
the knowledge of good and evil.
Chapters 1 and 2. And then the phrase, sin's crouching at your door, but you can rule
yeah,
it.
Yeah, rule it.
The word rule has appeared only one time in the story so far, and it's what the humans are given.
It's the image of God.
It's the image of God to rule over the world on God's behalf. Mm-hmm. And now we hear that you can rule your moral decisions if you choose. The implication is, okay, well, if I don't rule over sin...
Sin will have its way with
me. Sin will apparently rule me.
Yeah.
Which sounds a lot like how Paul views sin in Romans chapter 6, which he's almost certainly been reflecting on this very story in its vocabulary. So what does it mean to let...
He's meditated on it.
What does it mean to let sin rule you? It means that I now define as good that my brother must die.
That's the good thing. That's the right decision.
Thing. Yes.
The right decision because my life isn't working out the way I want it to work out.
Correct.
I'm not getting the favor from God.
Yeah.
What should I do? Well, maybe if I kill my brother, then I can get some of the favor.
Yeah. Or I'm now angry because I've been left out I'm the one who didn't get what I deserve. Yeah.
That's true. We don't get his motivation.
Yeah.
We just know he's angry.
Yeah.
And now he's going to kill his brother.
Yeah. For some reason.
That's good in his mind.
That's right. And so this is a good example of what Jerome Walsh was talking about. You have to fill out possibilities
in
your
mind.
Yeah,
so we just filled out two.
Yeah.
And then you could bring those forward.
I don't deserve what I've got in life, and I'm angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this other person is getting what I deserve. The good thing for me to do is whatever, to absorb, right?
Yeah.
Make my life more important than theirs.
Right.
And so I kill them.
Yeah.
That's one totally legitimate way of viewing what's going on here. And we could probably imagine two or three others.
Yeah.
But the point is that we're intentionally not given
the answer.
Cain's motivations are, so that we'll go through the exercise.
And wrestle with it.
And you walk away from that cup of tea.
Right.
Pondering Cain's motivations, learning a lot about yourself.
So like success in reading the Bible, like a devotional time, which is the phrase was used in my tradition, your quiet time, success isn't coming away with necessarily some more understanding or some clear principle.
Mm.
Success could just be coming away with an ambiguity that you need to wrestle with for the rest of the week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like that, right. Yeah.
That's success in and of itself.
Yep.
Which wasn't a, that's the, when I say freedom and excitement, that's what it brings. It's like, oh, cool.
Yes.
Like, this is something that I get to carry with me and wrestle with, and it can shape things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like some textbook that I just have to go and memorize answers and then be done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And every story is just a universe of this kind of thing. Right now, personally, and for a project I'm working on, I'm studying 1 and 2 Samuel.
Yeah.
So I'm in the thick of the narratives about Saul and David in the period where Saul goes from the chosen king, everybody's happy, to his descent into madness.
Mm.
And dude, I'm telling you, it's like, it is Breaking Bad. Or it's like, whatever, or the Godfather series. It's a whole story that through this level of brilliance, there's like 40 episode stories all packed next to each other, and every one is this brilliant. And you're watching this man descend into selfish madness, destructive madness. And it's so, I'm telling you, every time I read a new part and I'm taking notes and thinking about it, I'm walking away going like, oh my gosh, I am so screwed up. Gosh, help me.
It puts the fear of the Lord in you.
Help me. It does. It does, because you're just like, I could do this.
I could unravel.
I see these own patterns in my own behavior that could easily lead me down a path. But you have to allow yourself to enter into the story of this ancient character.
Yeah, you can't just float above it and principles from it. You gotta
really enter into the world of this narrative. And it's the same kind of thing. Why did Saul do that? Why didn't he listen to Samuel? Why did he offer the sacrifice then and not wait? And and you're wondering, and then it precisely gets you in the same headspace of, oh, am I ever impatient? Oh, sheesh, I think I am. I'm just like this guy. Oh, no. And it's so good.
Yeah.
But you have to take the time.
Can we keep going with four? I was just.
Okay. Oh, you want Genesis 4?
Yeah, okay.
I want to keep moving on. You want to keep going? Okay, all right, deal.
No, should we move on then?
No. What questions do you have? Let's keep going.
Well, okay, so verse 9. We're in verse 9.
He kills his brother. Yep.
Then the Lord says to Cain, "Where's your brother Abel?"
Mm-hmm.
This should probably help us. Or in the last chapter, when Adam and Eve eat the fruit, they hide.
And
God comes,
"Where are you?
Where are you?"
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like total hyperlink back to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That detail in the story.
Because
why would God? It's the same thing in Genesis 3. Like, why did God ask where they are?
Exactly.
And why is he now asking where Cain is?
So now he asks, "Where's your brother?
Where's your brother?"
Yep.
I don't know. He replied, "Am I my brother's keeper?"
So let's pause right there. So now it's a narrative statement. Just Cain, instead of the narrator telling us, and Cain thought to himself,
I'm not
accountable. You're the one who didn't regard my offering. Why are you? All we have is two words.
Am I responsible for my brother?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, am I my brother's keeper? And then that gets you thinking, well, oh.
No, you're his brother.
Yes, that's right. But am I the guarder, the protector of my brother?
Yeah. Am I the one to make sure my brother stays safe?
Yes.
No, that's your job.
You're the one that gave him favor.
Yeah. Yeah. Am I my, it's such a rich question.
Oh, man.
It gets you thinking, am I my brother's keeper? Well, I in one sense, I am.
Yeah, I'm everyone's in a way.
Yeah, he's a fellow human.
Everyone has Imago Dei.
Yeah. Yeah, within the narrative world, these are the only four humans. So,
or they're married at this point, right?
No, not yet. He's going to go find his mystery wife in a few paragraphs. So, yeah, it's such a rich line. And so you think, well, in once, yes, I guess you are. I wouldn't have put it that way. But now that you've put it that way, what a classic line.
Verse 10, the Lord says, what have you done? Listen.
Hold on. What have you done? It's exactly what he said to Adam and Eve.
Oh.
And to the serpent.
Okay.
What have you done?
What have you done?
Yep.
Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground.
Yes. Holy cow.
And so that's going to become a very significant idea in the Bible.
Yeah. Innocent blood crying out from the ground.
Yeah. That's a weird statement.
Hmm. Well, okay, so there's some cultural things underneath there, and then once some little details. So maybe let's just start from the ground. The word ground is the word adama,
right?
Which is
dirt,
the same
dust.
Connected to the word Adam, human, Adam.
Yeah.
So Adam comes from humanity comes from the adama.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to return back to the adama.
So if you were reading this in Hebrew,
yes,
it would be like your brother's blood cries from the adama.
Yes. Yeah.
And
it
immediately
triggers.
You're triggered like,
oh,
ground, humanity,
yes,
our role to cultivate the ground, that we came from the ground, like all this stuff. It's like all in the...
You came from the ground and to the ground you'll return, right? Genesis 3.
Yeah.
But here, Abel has returned to the ground, so to speak, but not in a legitimate form of dying at a ripe old age. Mm. Rather, it's his blood that's been spilled on the adama, the ground.
Yeah.
So then that the innocent blood lying on the ground, instead of this person being buried in the ground, the blood on the ground, and then there's a cultural thing about, and actually it's true, still in our culture, I think, burial is burial or cremation and the, you know, whatever you call that, depositing the ashes in a certain kind of space.
Mm.
What we see that is a form of closure.
Yeah.
Most cultures are looking for a way to find closure for the end of a human life. So many cultures have different practices and ways of doing this, but it's appropriate, or we equate it also with honor and dignity. Like if this person deserves burial as the proper way to honor who they are and so on. And so most cultures have an awareness that to die in a way in which your body is not properly dealt with is somehow unjust.
Mm.
And so especially it's true in biblical culture to not be buried is one of the most dishonorable, horrifying things you could imagine. To have your body just lie there in a field being rotting.
It's embarrassing.
And your blood spilling on the ground. And so you get this phrase that blood spilled on the ground becomes like this megaphone to the just, good creator God.
Mm.
And that he notices all of the innocent blood spilled on the ground and it cries out to him.
Yeah.
It's very powerful. And it's not the only time used in the Bible.
Right.
This image of the unburied or the blood crying out from the ground.
Mm.
Happens. It's the same phrase that's used of the Israelites in slavery, and they cried out, and their cry rose up to God in Exodus chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same phrase, crying out.
What about like in the psalm where the rocks will cry out? Is it the same kind of, is it the same phrase?
Oh, well, that's more about creation
having
this voice that praises God.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. Things that cry out to God.
Yeah. Things
so
that cry out to
creation
God.
Creation does.
Yeah.
And also
blood from
the suffering of slavery is a cry that God hears. God hears the cry of creation and praise. And God also hears the cry of innocent blood.
Mm.
So now we hear this is the statement that, oh my gosh, like human life matters to the creator of life.
Mm.
And so much so that God notices even the cry of an innocent death in the middle of a field where you thought nobody was listening. Why'd they go out in the field?
Mm.
No one's going to know and hear.
No one will find him in the field.
But then you realize God knows and he hears. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, verse 11.
So
now
that
you're,
happens.
Now you're under a curse.
You're cursed from the Adama.
Yeah, you're driven from the Adama. And what in Genesis 3, he's cursed, but the curse is actually that the ground is going to be harder to deal with. Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of link here?
In Genesis 3?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, in Genesis 3, you're set to cultivate the garden.
Yes.
Excuse me. This is Genesis 2. Genesis 2,
right.
Here's the garden. Cultivate it. Work it. Become farmers.
Yeah.
Genesis 3, now that
you've chosen
to eat of the fruit, know and define good and evil on your own terms, the environment, both relational environment and your experience of life here is going to be one of hostility and tension rather than ease and peace.
Yeah.
But you're still working the Adama, the mm-hmm. ground, mm-hmm. in Genesis 3.
And you're still working it.
It's just hard.
And now
what he's being cursed from is, now you don't even get to stay put in one place
right.
to work the ground. You're cursed away from the ground, meaning, and it's what he says, you're going to be a wanderer.
You're not going to have your own plot of land.
Correct.
And that's like an even like worse situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's becoming the exile and sojourner who doesn't have a home anymore.
A restless wanderer on the earth.
Yes.
And so Cain, in verse 13, says, that's harsh.
Yeah, yeah.
My punishment's more than I can bear.
Yeah.
You're driving me from the land.
Yes.
And I will be hidden from your presence, which, by the way, if you're like reading carefully, you're like, God didn't say he'd be hidden from your presence. So Cain's like putting words in God's mouth.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he assumes that, if I'm a wanderer, then God is no longer with me.
Which I guess you can understand why you would assume that at this point, but it is an assumption.
Yeah. And it's the introduction of a phrase, the hiding of God's presence or being hidden from God's presence becomes a negative image of God's judgment or of that God's angry or withholding his presence from me.
Oh, if God's presence
is... If God's presence is not with me, I'm in danger.
It's interesting because Adam and Eve are the ones that hide.
Yes, yeah.
In the last
story.
Yeah. Okay. And then...
And then everyone who finds me is going to kill me. So if your presence isn't with me to guard and protect me...
Yeah, it's over for me. So basically you're punishing me to death.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting, like he's being such a whiner... Mm-hmm. for having been punished for killing someone. But I'm a whiner too, so I get it.
Yes. So, sorry, one more detail there. In verse 14, he says, you have banished me. It's exactly the word used to describe, and God banished Adam and Eve from the garden in chapter 3.
So another
parallel stories
of being banished.
But the banishment is away from the presence, so to speak, in Genesis 3, which means away from the garden. And then here, it's another form of banishment.
The banishment from having, a place to call your own,
to
become a wanderer.
Yeah. And so this sets up the image then to give in to sin, to not rule over it, but to allow bitterness and anger and resentment to rule me. Mm. And then to begin to make choices and have habits of behavior that have destructive relational results.
Yeah.
That will result in greater and greater isolation, becoming a more and more isolated wanderer in the world,
right?
With no home.
Yeah,
and the phrase that's used is to be hidden from God's presence. Yeah. I'm in God's world, but I'm becoming more and more hidden from God through my own moral failures.
Yeah,
and who doesn't know that experience? Mm. Destructive choices that break down your relationships. That continue to isolate you more and more as you go on through life. And that experience of being in the world as an exile because of my own stupid decisions, that is such an important image in the biblical story.
Yeah.
We're going to make a whole video just about this concept of exile and banishment. So once again, this story is
loaded.
Loaded.
All right, we can stop there.
Okay.
The Mark of Cain's next, but we don't even get to it. Okay.
All right.
Thanks for indulging me. So what just happened? We were showing how a chapter in the Bible is
half a chapter, 14 sentences.
Verses.
Yeah, right.
So packed, so dense, full of ambiguities, and we could sit there and we can start to see as we wrestle with those ambiguities how it connects to the rest of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And in that way, not only is it telling us what the story is about, it's actually messing with us.
Yeah.
And we're realizing like, whoa, when I get bitter, I'm letting sin devour me. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that is being left without a home, being isolated and wandering. And I get that when it comes to this story, but I also get that when it comes to my relationships with mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. relationships with my wife or whatever it is. And so now by meditating on this, it's becoming much more significant. So that's the Bible as meditation literature.
Okay, yes. So that's a good summary. Now watch this. This story is giving us language and imagery, especially the way sin gets personified, mm-hmm. that's going to find greater clarification way later in the Bible. Hmm. There's this little paragraph in the New Testament in the letter of 1 John, chapter 3. Okay. And he's talking about people who are children of the devil and children of God.
Okay.
Chapter 3, verse 7. He says, "Little children, make sure nobody deceives you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, just like God is righteous. The one who practices sin," remember Genesis yeah. 4, it's the first time that word occurs.
Yeah.
"The one who practices sin or does sin is of the devil, for the devil sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. No one who is born of God does sin, because God's seed abides in him. He cannot sin because he's born of God." So John's got this idea that you can either be a child of God because God's seed is in you, and therefore you are a part of God's seed, or you can be the seed or the child of the devil because you do sin. And you realize all this vocabulary comes from Genesis 3 and 4.
Yeah.
That there's the seed of the serpent mm-hmm. and the seed of the woman. But there is coming one, a seed of the woman, who's going to crush the head of the serpent, which John phrases here as the Son of God, who came to destroy the works of the devil.
Yeah.
But even though that's happened in Jesus, the victory over sin and spiritual evil, you and I still have a choice of what seed we want to be a part of. Mm. So at verse 10, he says, "By this, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who doesn't do righteousness is not of God, nor the one who doesn't love his brother." This is the message we've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not like Cain, who was...
Yeah, at this point, you didn't think he was referencing to
yes.
these stories. Now yeah. he's like, let me just name drop Cain.
Yeah, not like Cain, who was of the evil one. So think Genesis 3 said there would be the seed of the serpent. And you entertain two possibilities there, at least. This is talking about baby snakes. Or it's talking about people who give in to the serpent's temptation, just like.
Yeah.
And then you get Genesis 4, which is somebody facing another temptation. Mm. And the temptation is called sin. Mm. And you watch Cain do it. Which now you realize, like, oh, I'm supposed to see people who give in to sin as allowing themselves to become the seed of the serpent.
Part of the legacy of evil.
The legacy of evil. And so that's exactly what he says here. Don't be like Cain, who was of the evil one and so murdered his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Remember, that was the question we asked. He just says, because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous.
Yeah.
So what he's done
doesn't
is
really
he's...
doesn't really give an explanation.
Well, what he's saying is that Cain and Abel are these archetypes of the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Mm. And the more that I make give in to evil and act on those evil, whatever, temptations or purposes, I become of the evil one. Mm. It becomes my nature.
Identity, yeah.
But there is a different seed, a different nature that I can receive as a gift, and it's to become the seed of the woman, leading to the overcoming of evil, that's the story of Jesus. Hmm. So why this little paragraph is great is, one, it shows us a New Testament author who's read...
Who has meditated on
Genesis 3 and 4.
Yeah.
But also, they're also reading that story in light of where it all led to in Jesus. Mm-hmm. John is reading the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. And then he goes back and he meditates on every single story of the Old Testament now in light of the whole story.
Yeah.
And so it's both allowing each story as to become a little universe of meditation to reflect on myself and life and God. And then it's also learning how to read backwards and forwards mm-hmm. and read every story and poem in light of every other story and poem as a unified whole. And this is what we mean when we say reading the Bible as ancient Jewish meditation literature.
Yes, that's great.
Why do we use the word meditation? That's an intentional ambiguity we have not answered up to this point.
Well, because the idea of meditating is slowing down and concentrating on something.
Yes.
But did you pull that word out of a dictionary or a thesaurus and go, oh, that's a good word?
Right. Yeah. So I didn't just think it up. It's actually the way the Bible portrays the ideal reader of this kind of literature. and the place where the Bible describes the ideal Bible reader is in Psalm 1.
Okay.
So, this is great. Now we're looking at a poem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we did some
narrative,
story.
Now narrative, we're looking at a poem.
And we looked at some discourse in John, and now we're looking at a poem.
So it begins with how blessed, how fortunate is a person who doesn't do three things. He doesn't walk, stand, or sit in the company of certain people. He doesn't walk the plans of the wicked. Yep. He doesn't stand in the path of sinners.
Okay.
Or sit in the seat of mockers, scoffers. Okay. So each of these, to walk is a very common image mm-hmm. of your way of life.
Okay.
Life as a path or life as a journey.
The metaphor is life as
to
a journey.
To stand is about where you're seated and stationed and rooted.
Your position.
Oh, excuse me, where you stand, your position, sorry. And then where you sit is where you're rooted. Mm. So all these images of life as a journey, life as a position.
Yeah, right.
And life as a, like a location where you're, as a home base.
Yeah, standing is kind of like your vantage point and sitting seems to be more like your home base. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the wicked, the rasha, the sinners, and the scoffers.
So that could be your way of life. That could be your point of view. Mm-hmm. That could be your starting position.
Yes. And the fortunate human is the one who doesn't end up in any of those scenarios. Hmm. So if the fortunate person doesn't end up pursuing those kinds of whatever life trajectories, mm-hmm. then what do they do that makes them so fortunate? Mm-hmm. And what we're told is the blessed person's delight is in the Torah of Yahweh.
Yeah. Which, if you're reading along, it says in NIV, it says the law of the
Lord. The law, excuse me. Yes, the law of the Lord.
But that's referring to the Torah.
The Hebrew word is Torah.
The teaching.
Yeah. Which,
Genesis through
in its most limited sense, can refer to just teaching that an elder gives, a priest gives, or a prophet. The phrase Torah of Moses or Torah of the Lord can come to refer to the body of covenant literature connected with Moses. It can also come to refer to just biblical literature as a whole.
Yeah. So delight in the Bible.
Delight in the Bible.
In Scripture.
The Bible nerd. So they first of all find delight. Why is it that they find delight? Or how do they express that delight? Well, what they do is every day and night, they meditate on the Torah. So meditate is an English word in vogue.
Yeah.
right now.
And we typically think of sitting quietly, emptying your mind.
Yes.
And maybe repeating a phrase or something.
No, that's right.
Listening to your breathing.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in terms of the wave of influence, of like yoga or mindfulness.
Right.
I mean, there's so much wisdom to engaging in these habits of breathing and emptying your mind for the purpose of kind of calming yourself.
Yeah.
That's not at all what's being described
here. That's not the meditation here.
Rather than emptying your mind, this form of meditation is about filling your mind, but about filling your mind with something other than just your own thoughts.
Right, yeah.
So the word meditate in Hebrew is hagah. Hagah. And it occurs about like 8 or 9 times in the whole. So it's not a super common word, but it's used enough. We have a very clear picture. And actually, the majority of times that it's used, it's animals that do it.
Oh, they're meditating? Oh, interesting.
So it describes what a bear does over its prey.
A bear captures its prey.
A raccoon. It kills a raccoon. Or in biblical terms, it would be like a rock badger or a hyrax or something. And so, yeah, it's like eating it.
It's eating it.
So what sounds does a big bear make because it's eating an animal?
Eating sounds.
Yeah. It's like, oh,
right, yeah.
Like mouth noises.
Right, yeah.
Right? Like growling. Well, the English word we have for that is growl.
Growl, but also the smacking and the
the
enjoyment.
Yeah. Two times, this word, once in Isaiah 59, once in Ezekiel 7, it describes what doves do up in the little rock crevice or on, you know, in the eaves of a building. The doves will go up there and
meditate
and hagah.
Hagah.
Which we have.
Making their little noises, their dove noises.
Yes. We have a very specific word for that in English. Cooing, yeah.
Yeah.
Like that. So in both cases, it's a low, it's a quiet, low, primal, guttural sound.
Yeah. Right. While you're concentrating on something. Well, with the bear concentrating on eating.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the pigeons are concentrating on.
So this is what the fortunate person does to the Bible. Day and night. They hagah in it.
And the word we use is meditate.
So, yeah. So meditate, it's fine because it is about focus.
Mm-hmm.
But what we miss with meditate is the idea of quiet reading. What this is envisioning is somebody who quietly reads the Bible aloud to themselves for the purpose of focusing on it.
Mm.
And I've begun this practice too, and I notice it all the time.
Interesting.
In my habit times of reading the Bible, I read it aloud, quietly to myself. And it engages my whole body and mind in a way that's very different than when I read silently.
Mm.
And so you read it aloud all the time. And then when you read it aloud all the time, you also begin to think about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's what fills your mind.
Mm.
Why did Cain do that? Why did Saul do that? Why is Genesis 3 next to Genesis 4?
Hmm.
And why is banishment used in both stories? And what why is banishment an image for the consequences of sin?
Yeah, and then these are the questions that are filling your thoughts during the day, then when you encounter your own life situation, these are the words and the images and ideas that you have to process your life.
Yes.
Which is what the point is.
Correct.
Is not just to read this to read it, but for it to begin to shape you.
Yeah. So first of all, Psalm 1 is saying that's the ideal way to engage biblical literature.
Yeah.
Is to read it aloud quietly to yourself on a regular basis so that it's what you think about constantly.
Yeah.
It's one thing. The second thing is also the statement is saying that the Bible has been designed to be the kind of literature that you can read and think about for a lifetime.
Mm.
Implied here is that there's enough to think about.
Day and night.
To read and think about every day for the rest of your life, and you will not have exhausted the depth and richness of what's going on here. So what is that? That assumes that the Bible is designed with the kind of depth to it that no one human mind can exhaust it, even in the course of a whole lifetime.
Right.
And I brought this up before in some previous podcast episode, but about the Dead Sea Scroll community.
Oh, yeah.
And now we have their own literature about their habits and their practices.
Oh, yeah.
It's called The Rule of the Community.
They had to, like, read one passage for like 10 years or something.
Well, you had to be a Bible nerd already, be like 10 years immersed in what they call, and they called the Bible, the scroll of meditation, and they use exactly this word from Psalm 1. They got the idea from Psalm 1.
Yeah.
So they were trying to be a community of Psalm 1 type people.
Mm.
And what Psalm 1 is telling us is both the ideal readers, because the producers of the Bible were these kinds of people.
Right.
Total Bible nerds.
Yeah.
And so you both had to have a decade of Bible nerddom under your belt. And then the life of the community is decades of daily scripture reading, meditation, and prayer, along with other day-to-day life activities.
Mm.
And so in their minds, it takes a whole community of people, a lifetime's worth of, not even one human mind can comprehend everything that's going on here. You need a group of people to read and meditate on it together. And the outcome of that is this image of the tree planted by streams of water, which it's a Garden of Eden image of the eternal tree.
Verse 3.
The eternal tree. It's an unending stream. The scriptures are an unending supply of life and richness, which results in a human life that's fruitful.
Yeah.
If you think about things like the Cain and Abel narrative, apparently—
it's destructive. It's a destructive life.
Yeah.
Oh, but if you think about it—
Yeah, if you think about it—
It's going to bring you life.
It's going to bring good things into your life.
Yeah.
And that's what the Bible's designed to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this isn't a paradigm that either of us knew about, you know, through our own growing up experiences. Like, the Bible was just not this.
Yeah.
And then once you grasp that the Bible is this, then all of a sudden you realize, oh, like, biblical narrative is going to be a unique kind of thing.
Yeah.
If it's written in this culture with this set of assumptions and design techniques. And biblical poetry is going to differ from other cultures' poetry. Mm-hmm. Biblical speeches, biblical laws, biblical whatever.
Yeah.
It's all going to have a unique flavor that we're calling ancient Jewish meditation literature.
So the idea isn't mastery.
Mm.
It isn't some sort of completeness where eventually you will crack all the codes and have all the answers.
Mm.
But
yes, but you will. You are supposed to grow in your competency and confidence.
Yes, but it's not about. Yeah, it won't stay ambiguous.
Correct.
And shallow. It'll continue to get deeper and more meaningful.
Yeah, yeah. You do grow and you do learn, but at the same time, you're aware that this is a deep, deep well, that there's always more to discover, and that I could always be wrong, probably about lots of things, that after another decade of life and meditation on the scriptures, I'll have an even more developed view of things that hopefully will be more truthful and faithful. But there you go. That's the kind of humans the Bible is meant to produce. It's like faithful humans who rule the world well. In partnership with
because
God.
They're choosing the good.
Yes.
And not letting sin devour them.
Yeah, not letting sin eat their lunch every day.
Eat their lunch.
Yeah.
I love that image. Thank you for listening to the Bible Project Podcast. We've got lots of other resources on our website. We've got videos and study notes. It's all on our website, thebibleproject.com. If you're new to the podcast, I'd recommend checking out our episode on What's the Story of the Bible? It's a good overview of the entire biblical narrative, and it's not the story you would likely expect. We're a nonprofit in Portland, Oregon. We make these resources for free because of a growing number of supporters just like you. So thanks for being a part of this with us.